This is tape two of the interview with Professor Chitra Smith. When the last tape ended, you were talking about the dual focus of James Madison,
right.
Law school, and also right. Directed toward foreign service, or not foreign service, but
foreign service, among other things, public service in general. Mm-hmm. You know, the notion of responsible elite public officials, you know, on the model of the French. Well, that's something else. So it was Dick Zinman and Jack Painter who organized what was essentially the pre-law curriculum in Madison, but you would have never known it from its name because it was called, are you ready for this? Mm-hmm. Justice, Morality, and Constitutional Democracy. Mm-hmm. It was the name of an academic curriculum. Justice, Morality, and Constitutional Democracy. And in Madison it was known as JMCD, not unnaturally. And so these people like the arrogant Mike McConnell, who wanted to become lawyers, brilliant lawyers, couldn't be arrogant when they were around Dick Zinman because he is just unbelievably erudite and incredibly nice. I mean, he's just an absolutely angelic human being. And at the same time, he has this sort of brilliant, Talmudically honed brain. He's a lovely man. Anyway, thanks to Dick Zinman and Jack Painter, JMCD became a really superb pre-law program. And it was never formally so identified, but the other fields, like the one that I was more into, I was in two fields in Madison. One was international relations, and the other was what was called socio-economic policy problems, which is now called political economy. Okay? So what's now political economy is what I was sort of a founding member of, that concentration in Madison. And of course the students in these two interest streams had a lot of interest in each other. You know, it's clear that they were in fields that overlapped and melded. Some intended to go to law school, some intended to go to fancy graduate schools, but basically their interest areas overlapped. So it was a very wonderful, lively social life there among the students, and the interactions with the faculty were very, very, they took a lot for granted, these kids. Mm-hmm. They really expected you to be available almost any time they had a great thought. Mm-hmm. Or not so great thought. I used to spend so much time on academic advising that I would stay at night to work to prepare my lectures. And I would be in my office in Case Hall at 9 o'clock at night working away on spiffing up tomorrow's lecture. And there'd be a knock on the door. I'm not making this up. This actually happened. There would be three girls in dressing gowns, you know, one of them with curlers in her hair, saying, "Can we come in? Can we talk to you?" Yes. This was an epic conversation about girls who were bright and good students who felt persecuted by the sisters for not being feminists and for not having great ambitions and for wanting to become good wives and mothers. And they were willing to work, but they had no flaming career interests. And these girls felt so hassled in the atmosphere here. We had a very aggressive bunch of libbers on the faculty here. Mm-hmm. And I was viewed as a traitor to my class by them, but I became sort of den mother for the girls in Madison who were perfectly good. I mean, they kept up, they were among the best students, some of them. But they did not have career ambitions as a central part of their conception of the good life. And I was sort of their defender and their consoler and their, you know, I would give them pep talks about how good it was and how important it was to be like these Victorian ladies who raised magnificent sons instead of going out to run for parliament, you know? And so, you see, again, I'm drifting, because what I wanted to explain was some of the excesses of that intimacy in Madison, that you couldn't work at your own office without the girls coming in their dorm attire to try, you know, the latest problem out on you. Mm-hmm. But, of course, I loved that particular group dearly, and students have a way of knowing whether you're fond of them or not. I mean, you could be... You can be carefully impartial about, you know, what you do for whom, you do the same for them. But the ones that are loved know it, and they will then accordingly impose on you.
How supportive of the residential college were the various presidents of the university, like John Hanna? Was he a tough sell at first?
Hanna was already gone. Now, who was after Hanna?
Horton?
Oh, yes, Wharton was very much aware of the fact that what he was getting was a crypto-elite program. You see, this is always the thing about Madison. It never had any admissions requirements or graduation requirements that were any different from any other. But within these standard parameters, the program was so demanding that we tended to get students who were extremely good, much better than average. And if you looked, I used to at one time keep tabs of the statistics, which you might find mind-boggling if you ever want to do archival work, on the SAT scores and ACT scores averages for the 16 colleges in the university, and then for departments within the colleges. And Madison and engineering were always at the top. And education and business were always at the bottom. And the spread was huge. Right? But in any case, Madison had this rather elite bunch of students because the program was so demanding that it was fun. It was a fun challenge for the good students. And the bad ones just didn't think it was worth the the average ones. We had some average ones, and we tended them very lovingly. And but the Madison student body was being given an elite education that was, you know, as good. I swear this is true. I know I tend to be a little hyperbolic. The first full sentence my son ever said, he started talking late, was, "Mommy, you always exaggerate." He had heard my husband say that, of course. You know? So,
you felt that they were getting a good...
Wharton, who knew an elite education when he saw one, not having had one himself, was very supportive. And of course, Madison kept producing these golden eggs, you know, in the form of Rhodes scholarships. And for years, the recruitment of good students to this university was really facilitated by the fact that Madison kept turning out these students that won Rhodes scholarships and Marshalls, which I've always thought were more intellectually demanding than the Rhodes. Incidentally, Paul Hunt's wife, Kathy, was a Marshall when he was a Rhodes. And she was at Cambridge, and he was at Oxford. And they were both undergraduates here. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful story. Oh, sometime, if you want to, we can talk about this some more, but there is an extraordinarily interesting group of people on campus, some of whom you ought to interview. I think there must be about maybe 15 or 20 by now. These are Honors College graduates. MSU products, Honors College graduates. The reason that came to me is that Madison and Honors College, between them, produce these golden eggs of students who went to prestige fellowships and prestige graduate schools. The Honors College had a lot to do with it. That's where I went after Madison, you know. But, now wait a minute, where was I with this? It was a very
different... You're talking about the group of 15 to 20 exactly. students?
No, former students,
oh,
alumni,
okay.
who are now MSU faculty members, you know. These people would typically graduate from something, say chemistry and honors college. They would then go away to some prestigious graduate school, and then they might work at some prestigious school, but then they would ultimately come back and join the faculty at Michigan State. Mm-hmm. And we have at least 15, I think there may be more now, such people, of whom Kathy and Paul Hunt are two. And another one, that's why I brought this up, you want, might want to sort of put him on your list, is Eric Goodman, who is an engineer, mathematician, whatever. He's in computer science. And terribly brainy computer science whiz kid, he used to be. And so there are these Honors College alumni from very different fields. The woman in history is another one. Tess Tavermina. Tess Tavermina is a... No, is she...
In yeah. linguistics? Or
no, she's in... English?
She was associate dean, but then she went back to back to the disciplines in College of Arts and Letters.
I think maybe English.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, because she used to run poetry workshops mm-hmm. during mm-hmm. the summer, you know, national poetry mm-hmm. workshops. Tess Tavermina, one of the few really good women. I mean, there was an awful lot of this sisterhood business and a tremendous amount of second-rate, ambitious feminism run rampant. But there were a few really superb women that sort of slid in there without being noticed by the sisters, and who in some cases were rejected by them as not counting as female appointments because they didn't have the right ideology.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
But among the really good women, Tess Tavermina was one, and another is very old, and if you're going to talk to her, you must do it soon, because she is, you know, she's hooked up to one of these things, breathing deals, and mm-hmm. she's very happy and cheerful. She's not, she doesn't act moribund, but she is, basically, if you want to be. And this is a different part of the university altogether, and I will tell you later, we don't want to do it here, you're getting this awful mixed salad here of references to everything. So say to me Gwen Norell mm-hmm. after we get through, and then I'll explain why she...
We've spoken with Gwen.
Oh, you have?
We have. Wonderful energy.
Isn't she a wonderful lady? Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Not just about athletics. It talked about her role in the Detroit Project, Project Ethel, some of the attracting some of the top students here, her academic advising.
Did she tell you that she was nurturing black athletes before anybody had ever thought of any
yeah.
of that?
Yeah.
I mean, she really, she's one of my favorite people, mm-hmm. Gwen Norell.
Mm-hmm.
And so, okay, you're doing all right. You're doing something right if you've already netted her.
It was a wonderful interview.
All
she,
right.
she enjoyed, I think, the opportunity to yes. talk about some of the things that she'd been doing.
Well, she's like me. The university was her life for mm-hmm. many years, and mm-hmm. she really felt strongly about the good things that she tried to accomplish, mm-hmm. you know? So she had
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but you mentioned the issue of the Rhodes Scholars and the Honors College graduates coming back, ultimately.
Yes.
It seems to be an interesting subtext of when talking with a lot of the people, whether it was Pauline Adams in reference to Walter, the issue of what keeps people here.
Ah.
And the fact that, for example, when you came, did you anticipate that you would be here, in a sense, most of your career?
No, I feel that this is my home, and I have felt this for decades. Mm-hmm. And you're asking how come so many people feel that, mm-hmm. right?
Yes. I mean, I'm hearing it from many of the people that I interview. And in your own experience, what is it that maybe either kept you here, that has attracted you to staying at this place?
This is a very, very good question, and I am, you know, I'm fairly glib most of the time. But I'm sure there must be some complex and valuable answers, but I have to think. Mm-hmm. I will have
But in your experience too, as you know, being born not in the United States, having worldly experience during the war, seeing much of that, what attracts you to...
Yeah, and how come that this very provincial environment, you know, I grew up in very sort of metropolitan culture and so mm-hmm. forth. Mm-hmm.
You've raised your family here?
There is a basic decency, a basic respect for individuals. I mean, this is such a terrible cliche that, you know, I get a hot flash every time I hear it. But but there is that in this place. People give other people chances. They make allowances. They are... No, I have to put all this in the past tense because... Very frankly, I think that a lot of these things have faded under the, you know, the financial pressures and the research pressures. And but in its heyday, the university was a very nurturant place. And my second department head, whom you also have talked, if you haven't already, Douglas Dunham was chairman of the social science department in University College for years and years. Well, speak about nurturant chairman. See, he really obviously thought that his main job was to act as a sort of combination kindergarten teacher and psychiatric social worker to his to his faculty, you know. He was a lovely man. He was a Presbyterian elder, but a soft child one, you know. And he had all these sort of rectitude that you associate with that, but none of the stiffness and strictness.
Is he still living?
Yes. Mm-hmm. He lives, you know what, Bertram Hills has a little complex of houses that people can live in if they still intact, you know, and they don't need to live in the actual institution. Mm-hmm. But the cluster, they're called the cluster homes, and there may be 20 of them. They're all occupied, nearly all occupied, I think, by former retired faculty. Mm-hmm. And Doug Dunham and his wife, as I hope they're both still alive. I know he is because somebody talked about him recently. I'm not absolutely sure about his wife, so don't refer mm-hmm. to her until he does. But Doug Dunham went through the travails of the Basic College, University College transformation, you know, from the old model to the new model. All of it, you know, from soup to nuts. And he's just a tremendously constructive personality. I mean, you know, he's more like Gwen, not like me. I have a lot of nasty anecdotes that I keep repressing, you know. I have real reservations about many people. But Doug never spoke ill of anyone, even people who really practically destroyed him in the wars over, during the Cultural Revolution, you know, the late 60s, early 70s. Mm-hmm. So if you want to really, that's another really angelic person.
would you talk a little bit about the Honors College? Who were some of the directors that you worked with?
Well.
Or what were your duties?
Oh, a name just came to me. Itzerda. Stan Itzerda. Stan Itzerda was the founding dean of the Honors College, a director of the Honors College. And he was sort of a humanities type, very much. In fact, he taught in humanities. But he was a very highbrow humanities type, and also into philosophy and religion seriously. You know. He must be retired now, but he went from here to be at Wesleyan, which is the Wesleyan in New England somewhere, or on the East Coast. There are two Wesleyans.
Did he end up at Cornell, or no? I
don't know.
Okay.
But anyway, Idzerda is spelled I-D-Z-E-R-D-A, Idzerda. And he was, I think that the Honors College would have never made it through all the populist flack at this university if Stan Idzerda hadn't personally convinced people that it couldn't be all bad if a nice guy like that was for it. this elitism thing has been a very bitter, it's not just sort of a little phrase people get off, It was a profound resentment among many people, especially in University College. University College was really the number one enemy of the establishment of the Honors College. And it's just my luck that I managed to be happy in both. And then the next director was Frank Brackington, who is off, has some kind of high administrative position in a college in the South somewhere, I think, no. He was a natural scientist. I'm getting this fused image of Madison and the Honors College. I'm talking about Honors College. So it was Stan Idzerda, who was just totally admirable and very charismatic. He was sort of a little ugly man with tremendous charisma. So, oh, damn it. I'm really being quite infantile here. I'm old enough to know that you edit what you say when it's being recorded for. Okay, well, anyway, Stan Idzerda was followed by Frank Brackington, who left after a few years. There must have been somebody else. And then there was Jim Pickering. Jim Pickering was the man who hired me. He was an English professor in Morrill Hall, and very bright and bubbly and sociable and energetic, charming, lots of charm, oodles of charm. Jim Pickering was the man who hired me, and when he left, Lee Winder presided. I won't say manipulated. I worked the system to get the successor of my choice, because I didn't want the job. I was associate director, and it would have been embarrassing for people to have, if it ever had come out. By this time, everyone had forgotten I never had a PhD. But if it had come out, it would have been extremely embarrassing. Yeah. So in any case, I was not a candidate, which put me in a good position. I was the Honors College staff's representative elected on the search committee, on Lee Winder's search committee, for the new director of the Honors College. And the director that after months and months was chosen was Don Lammers, who was chairman of the history department and who was my candidate. He had two sponsors. I mean, this was all strictly informal, but there was a very brainy, entertaining, clever man in the history department called Warren Cohen, whose diplomatic history, Chinese diplomatic history, is his field. And Warren Cohen was a close friend of my second boss, Lammers. Mm-hmm. Warren was a close friend of Don Lammers. And he and I were pretty good friends too. I mean, Warren Cohen and I were pretty good friends too. Partly because we both belonged to the Asian Studies Center. And it was Warren who thought that Don was getting bored with being chairman of the history department. And he said, wouldn't he make a nice director of the Honors College? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were having a drink after work, mm-hmm. across the street. I said, yeah, he would, wouldn't he? Mm-hmm. He's such a nice person. Not a nasty, ambitious guy who steps on people, and, you know. Well, anyway, Warren and I both thought he would make a very good director of the Honors College. And we had an all-university committee, you know, with, I used to call these, in fact, I invented this, I notice it now shows up in the record sometimes. This is a Noah's Ark committee, you know, if you have one from every place, mm-hmm. except that we didn't usually have two from every place, but we had Noah's Ark committees with at least one from every place, from every college or interest group or whatever it happened to be. And ultimately, the interest groups that matter in this university are the colleges. So, so I sat on this Noah's Ark committee, and I recruited one of my friends who was chairman of the mechanical engineering department. But I will not give you his name because mm-hmm. this begins to get into the sort of thing that shouldn't be talked about. And I educated him on the value of the Honors College by having devised, before this came up, this search, a way that really super engineering students could get some kind of extra gloss and extra polish. And my hobby horse was that what they needed to be sold on was partly general education, but above all, speech, talk, writing more than any other single thing. And I sold him on this notion that in addition to honors courses in their engineering subject, which he did institute, I don't know if they still exist, but he did, that they ought to be required to take more, in effect, ATL-style stuff, not less, but more. Because in terms of their careers, I put this in very, very pragmatic terms. In terms of their careers, the difference between an engineer who never breaks away from a drafting table or a bench and an engineer who really makes it is his ability to write persuasively. You know? And that was my strategy for honors emphasis in engineering. And so there happened to be this engineering chairman on the search committee who had already been persuaded that he and I shared convictions. And he helped me. He said, you sure you want this man? And I said, yes. He helped me sell him to the rest of the committee. And, by God, I'll say that even if it does embarrass me. There were, of course, some affirmative action candidates for the directorship. And the sisterhood was very aggressive. They thought that looked like a good plum for them. We also had, I think, a black candidate. In any case, when we sent our recommendation to Lee, he had the nerve to call me in. No, did he call? Say this to me on the phone, on person. I don't suppose it really matters, but in effect, he wondered just how come we came to that conclusion, how come we hadn't come to some other conclusion, which was, one talked that way in those days when one was pressing for an affirmative action. appointment. And there was a lot of that pressure in the university, and I don't care who hears me say that. That's my main kind of whistleblowing thing in my record, is I was always opposed to cheapening the currency in faculty appointments, which is what we did, and I don't care. I mean, I think if some genuinely impartial body of experts did a systematic study of affirmative action appointments, I think it could be demonstrated that the average quality of these was lower than was available to the university. Only in a very few cases did it result in real embarrassments. I mean, people turned out to be unfit or substandard. There were very few of those. But there were scores of cases